Hey guys, welcome to Ride Owl Politics, coming to you from Miami, Florida. My name is Ariana Mendez. I'm a Cuban-American attorney from Florida and a Republican political activist and political columnist. Let me throw in a quick disclaimer here. Please don't interpret anything said on this show as legal advice. If you have a legal issue, consult with an attorney licensed in your jurisdiction. Thanks. Before we begin, I want to give a huge shout out to our audience who showed so much enthusiasm for last week's episode on Tara Reade's sexual assault allegations against Joe Biden. This was a really serious episode and you guys were great liking and sharing everything related to the episode and really had a great discussion with many of you on social media on the effects of this on our nation and how this topic affects everybody. And this is a very serious topic and we really appreciated your enthusiasm to tackle it. So thanks guys. Thank you for supporting the show and please continue to listen and support. So the COVID reopening process continues around the country. Here in Miami-Dade County, we're expected to enter phase one of reopening on Monday, May 18th. As the country starts to transition to the new normal, we are getting some surprising indications how the political landscape has changed during the pandemic. In special elections around the country, we have been getting some surprising results for Republicans. If you follow the media narrative, Republicans should not be winning elections anywhere. If President Trump has really done the horrendous job that the media is saying he has done in tackling the COVID issue, Republicans should be easily defeated in any special election around the country. But that's not what's happening, folks. In a special election in Southern California, I don't need to tell you that California is a liberal haven. I don't need to tell you that conservatism has died many times over in California. A Republican was able to win a House seat that they lost to Democrats in the 2018 midterms. This is very significant. The Democrat, Christy Smith, is a state assemblywoman, and she conceded defeat to Republican Mike Garcia this past Wednesday, May 13th. Now, whoever tells you that this is not a big deal is lying. This was a very close watch special election. This seat was formerly held by Representative Katie Hill, who resigned in disgrace. And this Republican, Mike Garcia, was able to do something that was considered unthinkable. He was able to flip a House seat that had gone blue as recent as 2018, red. That's incredible. That's a political dream. So who's Garcia? Who is this guy? Garcia is a first-generation American, a former naval aviator, who flew over more than 30 combat missions during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and a former business executive. He is a native of Santa Clarita and is a husband and father to two children. Now, if that weren't impressive enough, pay attention to the platform he used to win this election. He's running on a platform of strong border security, term limits, reducing the national debt, anti-socialism, job creation, and low taxes. So, if you're a political consultant and you look at that district in Southern California, I guarantee you the first piece of advice they're going to give, oh, you can run as a candidate, as a conservative candidate in this district. No, don't do it. It's not a good idea. You're going to be destroyed if you do that. Garcia did the exact opposite. He took a district that had been won by a Democrat in 2018, and he ran against the Democrat with a very bold red platform. And what I mean by bold red, in my book, there are two ways you can approach an election. Bold red or light red, if you're a Republican candidate. Bold red is that you adhere to the party line, you try to present ideas that are very conservative, and your platform is very distinct from the Democrat candidates. A pale red is, it's a more of a pastel candidate. It's a candidate that may want to appeal to the middle, so their positions are going to be not as conservative, more down the center, and they're trying to attract independence and trying to have a broader appeal. Each approach is different. Each approach has a different success rate, but candidates have to make a decision when they're running in a purple district whether they're going to try to galvanize the base by running on a bright red platform, or they're going to try to appeal to the center and try to get more independence in the general election. Mr. Garcia was running on a very bright red platform. Strong border security, term limits, reducing the national debt, anti-socialism. Can you believe it? In the liberal haven of California, you have a Republican in Southern California running on an anti-socialist platform. I mean, this is incredible. As a political scientist, as many of you know, I have a degree in political science and have done political consulting. That's incredible. That's a case study of how to run a bright red campaign in a purple district. Amazing. Now, this victory cannot be overstated. Just to give you guys some historical context, Hillary Clinton won this district by 7 points in 2016. Democrats, big wig Democrats, were coming out in full support for Christy Smith. In the weeks leading up to the end of the campaign, national Democrat figures like President Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Senator Kamala Harris were throwing their support for the Democrat. They needed her to win. This was essential. This was a very big race that they wanted to keep in the blue column. For President Trump, this is even a sweeter victory. President Trump supported Garcia in the last weekend before the election, and his Trump victory campaign held nearly 80 training events in support of Garcia and the Republican National Committee, spent nearly $1 million on the special election alone, and contacted over 1.4 million voters in Garcia's district. Now, for those of you out there that are political junkies like me, you need to understand that what was going on in this race was a test of everybody's ground game. The Democrats were trying to see if they could galvanize their people to come out, and Republicans were doing the same. But the fact that Republicans were able to contact 1.4 million voters in that district is incredible. Keep in mind, back in 2008 and 2012, Republicans were playing catch up to the Democrats' voter outreach efforts. So the fact that we now have voter outreach on the Republican side that can reach 1.4 million voters in a district, that is fascinating. That means that the Republican National Committee's outreach efforts has improved exponentially in the last few years. And it's also a testament to Trump's campaign, because they've been leading on voter outreach. This is amazing stuff. Like, it's from a political science standpoint, this is how politics is done, and this is how the game is played. And it's just fascinating to see how this unfolded. Now, that wasn't the only happy news Republicans had this week. Republicans were able to hold on to their seat in Wisconsin's 7th District. This was a district formerly held by Congressman Sean Duffy. And the person that won the district this week was Tom Tiffany, and he beat the Democrat by 14 points. This wasn't even close. I don't need to remind you guys that Wisconsin is a very important state for November. This was part of Hillary Clinton's blue wall that Trump blew a huge hole through in 2016. So any Democrat that has any hope of winning the White House needs to bring back Wisconsin into the blue column. So the fact that this guy, Tom Tiffany, was able to beat the Democrat by 14 points in an environment, supposedly, if you follow the media narrative, that should be horrendous for Republicans, because according to the media, Trump has done a horrific job of confronting the COVID issue. This is very interesting developments. If I'm a Democrat consultant or a Democrat strategist, I'm looking at these races and I'm getting worried. There's something going on out there that polls are not picking up. So if these special elections are any indication, the media, and if you're listening, listen to me closely, there may be a cruel surprise for you in November. Because if Republicans are winning these special elections during these pandemic crisis times, and in blue and blue-leaning states, you're in trouble. Your party is in big trouble. And I am ready to predict we could be seeing the first droplets of a red wave in November. This brings us to today's topic. What is the likelihood of a red wave in November? And how has COVID-19 changed the dynamics of doing politics in this country? If you're running for office right now, we're in the midst of a pandemic. That means you can't hold town halls, you can't hold rallies, and knocking on doors to get voters to know more about you is probably not a viable option at this point. So if you're a candidate running for office right now, how have you adapted to this changing landscape? So in order to discuss this, I needed a candidate. I needed somebody who was running for office, and I also needed somebody who was running in a district that has certain similarities with Mike Garcia. Why? Because just like Mike Garcia, Juan Fiol is running in a district that Republicans lost to Democrats in 2018. Who is Juan Fiol? Juan Fiol is a Miami native, a businessman, a realtor, and a lifelong conservative who is running for Congress in Florida's District 27. Now, let me provide some context. Florida District 27 is a very important district in South Florida, especially for the Cuban American community. Currently, the seat is represented by Democrat Donna Shalala since 2018. The seat was formerly held by Republican Ileana Ross Layton for 30 years until she announced her retirement in 2017. Ross Layton was the first Hispanic woman elected to Congress, and she was a very fiercely anti-communist and an advocate for human rights. In 2018, Donna Shalala won the seat with 51.8% of the vote and beat Republican Maria Elvira Salazar in the general election. So Juan Fiol is running against Maria Elvira in the Republican primary to decide who's going to face off against Donna Shalala in November. So Juan would be the perfect person to ask, how has the pandemic affected campaigns around the country? And how his district, District 27, could have a lot in common with Mike Garcia's district in California, two districts lost in 2018 were flipped from the red to blue column, and how they could potentially be part of the red wave in November. Juan, welcome to the show. I'm glad you're here because as I was telling our audience, we're having some interesting developments around the country with special elections and very interesting results for Republican candidates. And you're running for a district that was formerly held by a Republican, Ileana Ross Layton, for over 30 years. She retired in 2017, and Donna Shalala, Democrat, is now representing that district. So tell our audience a little bit about yourself and why is District 27 so important this November?
Well, District 27 is very important because Republicans held this seat for almost 30 years, and it wasn't until 2018 that Ileana Ross Layton retired that we lost the seat to the Democrat Donna Shalala. And we need every seat in Congress to help the president. So the president needs our help for sure. And the Cuban community, the Venezuelan community, the Nicaraguan community need another voice in Congress, which right now there's just maybe one, maybe two, but that's it. And before we used to have voices in Congress. I've been involved with the anti-Castro movement since I was born, basically. I was brought into it. My parents were both part of the Brigade 2506. My father was in the Navy of the Brigade 2506, and my mother was in the training camps. Even though she didn't participate in the actual fighting, she would have gone if it wasn't because Kennedy didn't allow her to. So I was brought up in this. I know the entire every movement, the entire anti-Castro movement. And I've always been, somewhat involved in politics. It wasn't until 2015 that Donald Trump decided to run, that I decided to help him out. And that's when I realized that the left, the right, and the press and everybody was against him. And I said, that's my guy. So I became the first co-chairman of the Miami-Dade for a Trump campaign back in 2015. And I've been involved up until very recently. And I decided, when I saw that we lost the seat to Shalala, and that the candidates that the establishment Republican Party would throw into the ring, I thought, you know, it really did a big disservice to our community. So that's why I decided to run, and hopefully I'm able to make it to go up against, make it past the primary to go up against Donna Shalala, because I don't believe Donna Shalala understands our community, understands the needs of our community, of District 27, which is comprised of a lot of Cuban dissidents, a lot of Venezuelan dissidents, a lot of Nicaraguan dissidents. And there's also a large section of people are homegrown, Americans that live down south in Pinecrest and in other areas in Palmetto Bay and Cutler Bay. And I grew up here. I was born here, and I think I identify with everyone, with every group that we have here, including the Haitian community. So I think I represent the community well. I don't think Shalala knows anything about this community. I do. I've lived here all my life. I was born here, and I would like to represent us in Congress.
And you have such an incredible story. You mentioned your parents. Your mother was ahead of her time. What she was doing, helping out with the training of the soldiers during that time period, it's really quite incredible. So you have a family that's not afraid to fight for what they believe in. And I think you carry on that tradition very well.
But I must add, it wasn't just my mother. It was my mother's cousins, my mother's, some of her cousins and a lot of her friends. It wasn't just her. It was a group of women who took part in that movement that, you know, many people don't know about. But I have some proof that it actually did occur.
That's incredible. It was a family affair thing. Everybody was involved. That's great.
I would say at the early days, absolutely. Well, actually, our entire lives, absolutely.
That's fantastic. And I think you have that story that kind of relates to the Hispanic community. It doesn't matter where you come from. If you're an immigrant living in South Florida, that story connects with them. And I think what you say about Donna Shalala not really being able to represent the community, District 27, especially, and how diverse that district is spot on. And I wanted to ask you...
The thing is that she doesn't, I don't think she could represent any group at all. And I believe I could represent every group.
No, that's a good point. I think that you understand kind of the multi-layered identity to District 27. There's a lot of different people, a lot of different ethnicities in that district. So it's a very good thing that you pointed that out. So I also, you mentioned the establishment, and your main opponent in the primary is Maria Elvira Salazar. She ran last time, lost to Shalala. You're not running away from the fact that you supported Donald Trump, and she was criticized for trying to run away from President Trump in the last election. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Do you think that in order to go against Shalala and win, you need to embrace, you know, a very bold agenda that's not afraid of acknowledging President Trump and being an independent candidate, which is important in every race, but still supporting the President of the United States when he comes from your own party?
You absolutely have to. You have to have a set of values that you're going to put forth. You can't just say, I go with whatever's popular today. That's what my opponent does. And I don't like attacking her. I never do. But now that you mention her, I like to show what I'm about. But if you ask a question, I will respond. It's not about what's popular today, what's not popular today. It's a matter of what are my beliefs? What are my core beliefs? My core beliefs is that I'm a Republican and I am a conservative. And I believe in all these things, and I've never wavered, not even 1% ever. This is what I believe in, and people respect that, and people, and you have to sell it to the public and tell them why they should vote for you, and because one of the things is I never waver. So that's my number one thing, and that's the one thing she cannot ever claim. She always wavers. She wavers in a conversation, in an interview, back and forth. She can't give a straight answer. I always give a straight answer. As a matter of fact, didn't even need to ask me because they already know what my answer is. So that's number one. And number two, I think that there's a lot of things that the Cuban community and the District 27 Nicaraguan community with the Haitian community and also the Venezuelan community could benefit from President Trump. One of the things is President Trump is going to put Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua back on the state sponsors terrorism list. That's something that Obama took Cuba off of it. I'm telling him to put it back, to put Cuba back on the list, and to add Venezuela and Nicaragua while he's at it. Okay, you know that's very important to those communities, and that's something that Shalala doesn't do. They won't do. And that's one thing that I could offer. I could speak to the presidency. Since he knows that I support him, he's going to go ahead and probably do it hands down. But of course, why hasn't he done it? Well, think about it. Who's representing the district? Shalala. And what does Shalala want? She wants to do business with Cuba. She wants to bring Cuba and the United States closer together. Like when Maria Elvira said that we're living in I forgot exactly what it was, in a glorious moment when Obama tried to bring Cuba and the United States together. Well, it's not a glorious moment. We have to put them in their place. And their place is that they are a narco-terrorist state, all three of them, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, and that they should be in the state's sponsor terrorism because of the narcotics that they sent to the United States and because they harbor criminals and all kinds of stuff that they do to our country. And people who are not Cuban, or who are not Venezuelan, who are not Nicaraguan, say, well, what does that have to do with me? Well, it has a lot to do with you, because the majority of those drugs coming through the Mexican border, guess who sends them? Maduro, Castro, Ortega from Nicaragua. That's who sends those drugs here. And we have to stop the onslaught of these drugs coming here, and nobody seems to do anything about it. It wasn't the president put a bounty on Maduro's head and some of his top commanders, because he understands that, yes, in fact, those people are sending us drugs and they are part of the terrorism list.
Sounds like you believe more pressure on Cuba is going to produce better results for the people of Cuba. And I think that's a very interesting discussion, because for a long time, especially during the Obama administration, there was kind of a point of view that less pressure on Cuba, having them come closer to the United States without them agreeing to any concessions, was the way to go, and something that Shalala embraced to a certain degree. You're on the other side of that.
Well, sure, because when you give the first of all, we have to identify why it's, forget the work of Cuban background or Hispanic background. Think of somebody who doesn't know anything about Cuba or Venezuela or Nicaragua. They have to identify what the problem with them is, and the problem is that they are the ones sending drugs over here. So they, by default, are our enemy. So we have to defeat that enemy, because they are attacking us with drugs. Okay, so now Obama and Shalala's approach, and to a great extent Maria Elvira's approach, because she thought it was a glorious moment, she said it on Fox News, they think that by embracing and by coming closer together with Castro, that somehow that's going to change things. Well, what happens is that when you do that, they start doing, the economy starts doing better, sure, but that regime gets more money, and they get more emboldened, and they have more power and more control over their people. So the only way to really defeat them is by crushing them economically, and hopefully the people will revolt and change will come.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. Cuba's not just a problem for the United States or for Cuban Americans, it's a problem for the whole region. It's this pariah that goes from state to state trying to see how much money they can extort from other governments, like they've done in Venezuela, and they're spreading their ideology. So I agree with you 100% on that. And I want to talk to you a little bit about COVID-19 and jobs. You know, Miami-Dade County is supposed to start opening up into phase one on May 18th. So how do you think we can, you know, start stimulating the economy again, getting us out of this very dark place that we're at right now?
I think that if people, if you could go to Publix, if you could go to Sedano's, your grocery store, if you could go to your hardware store, Lowe's or Ace or Home Depot, and wear a mask and keep 6 feet apart and just be a little conscientious of who coughs on you, or you cough on somebody, or not to cough on somebody else. If you could do that and safely go to a store, then why can't you do that and safely go to a factory, or safely go to a mom and pop business? Okay, the fact that they're only selecting several stores, major retailers, as those are the only businesses that are allowed to be open, is beyond ridiculous. Okay? If you could practice safe distancing in those stores, then why can't you practice those safe distancing everywhere else? And you can't punish everybody because a few of them don't do what they're supposed to do. Okay, it's enough is enough. You have to open. We have to open up our economy. We have to open up businesses. By you going Publix and Winn-Dixie and Sedano's are not, and Home Depot are not immune, okay, to COVID-19. You could catch it there the same way you could catch it at a doctor's office, at a dental office, as anywhere else. So you should be able to open up all of them, and open it up now, because, you know, the people that are getting hurt are the mom and pop stores, the small business owners, the people who really can't afford to be hurt, okay? And Walmart is taking over everybody, all of those, the slack that all those small companies, stores and different, retailers are leaving behind because they're shut down, because they're supposedly non-essential. Walmart's picking up the slack, and they're getting huge while everybody else is getting crushed. And it's nonsense. It really is. Because look, for example, Sweden never shut down. Sweden already reached herd immunity. People don't know what that is. Well, herd immunity is when the majority of the people already caught the disease, and they already and everybody, and they're not getting sick from it. Okay, so they're not catching it anymore. The majority of people created antibodies to it, and the cases start to tumble. That's what's happening now in Florida. As you can see, Georgia open, Florida open, and the cases keep tumbling down. Why? Because everybody already caught it. Italy also came out and said that 99% of the cases of the deaths related to COVID-19 in Italy were not necessarily COVID-19 deaths. They had other complications, and that just so happens they also had COVID-19, but they died from something else. So 99% of the cases in Italy were for something else. And here's the same thing: when we stop playing politics and really analyze, you know, what these people are dying from, they're going to realize that COVID-19 was probably not the reason why. So most people have caught it. Most people are getting tested for COVID-19, but they should really be getting tested to see if they already had it, and to see if they're immune to it, so they could be a donor for the vaccine. Anyway, I think that we cannot shut down our economy because we have, we can't. We have to keep going. We have to fight. And those that are most at risk, we have to take care of them even more, which is the elderly and those with other sicknesses, other immune system deficiencies. Those people we really have to be careful with, but everybody else has to get back to work. If not, our economy is going to collapse. And unfortunately, that's what some people want. That's what people want. For political reasons, they want our economy to get destroyed so that Trump doesn't get reelected in November. And I think that we have to, understand that this is a political, that this is no longer a health issue. This is a political issue. And we got to open up and open up now.
And when you say political, it's been so long ago since we lived in a pre-COVID-19 world. But before all of this started, we were living in the best economy the U.S. had ever seen. And that we were booming. Our job numbers were through the roof. Percentage of unemployed was at historic lows. And we had to shut down the economy because we needed to keep people safe. We needed hospital capacity to catch up to the demand from those that have been contracting the disease. So we put a stop to the most prosperous economy in human history so that we could take care of people. How do you think we can incentivize businesses to start hiring again so we can get those 33 million right now unemployed back to work?
I think that if you just tell them to open up, I think that this economy is big enough and strong enough and motivated enough to really pick up immediately. And another thing that they can do is start getting rid of government regulations. I'll give you a perfect example. The trucking industry. The trucking industry has been hammered during the COVID-19 crisis, and they've been completely ignored. And I wouldn't say completely. I just think that it hasn't been brought to the president's attention yet, but he's been catching on late. One of the things is the amount of taxes they have to pay, the amount of rolls that they have to pay, the amount of different government regulations that they have to pay to be able to transport those goods. And of course, there's a group of brokers that are taking advantage of them. And they're doing so even more so now during the crisis, which is basically price gouging. They're price gouging them during the crisis. And it's come to the knowledge of the if we're in a crisis and the truckers are the ones taking care of everybody, don't you think that those regulations should be lifted? And, I think they should. I don't think truckers should have those kind of incredible regulations. Get rid of them. And a lot of people have a lot of regulations when it comes to opening up small businesses. I think that we need to really cut back on red tape. If the president really wants, and not the president, but, Congress too, if they really want, the Republican Congress really wants to get this economy going, instead of giving them money, cut red tape, cut taxes, cut fees, get the government out of their way and watch our economy rebound in a heartbeat.
Very well said. And since I have you on the line, let's talk Michael Flynn. Tell me your opinion on that. That there's a new chapter every day, it seems. It just keeps getting worse and worse for Democrats.
They came out and they started accusing the president of doing this, doing that, when in fact they were the ones that were doing it. Here's the thing. People don't understand what's going on. A lot of people don't understand what unmasking is. Unmasking means that if they're surveilling a foreign company or foreign dignitary, and there's an American on the line, that American is masked. They put U.S. citizen one, U.S. citizen two, U.S. citizen three, because we as American citizens have certain rights that the only way that you could look at who that person on that phone call is if you have a warrant, if a judge tells you that, yes, you could unmask and see who that person behind that is. Now, they were taping these phone calls, and they were surveilling these phone calls because they wanted to know if there was any collusion with Russia or this or that. Of course, they found nothing. But what they did do was unmask those Americans on the phone, and that American 48 times was General Michael Flynn. Of course, that's illegal if you're using it for political purposes. And of course, we know that they're using it for political purposes, because that's the whole reason why Obama and Biden were so interested in this, is to see if they could use it against Trump in his election campaign. Think about this for a minute. Why did President Trump get impeached? He got impeached because supposedly he found out what the corruption that Biden's son was doing, and they said that it was because it was for political reasons. So, okay. So he does one phone call, and he didn't ask anything about a quid pro quo or not much. He just found out that there was some real corruption going on, and they impeached him because supposedly he may have used this. They didn't know if he did or not, but it sounded like if he was going to use it for political purposes. But yet, Obama and Biden 48 times do it to Michael Flynn. And oh, wait a minute, they get away with it? Why? Why did Richard Nixon get impeached? He did exactly the same thing Obama did. They uncovered a bunch of files to see what the opposition was up to, and they got caught. Because back in the day, there wasn't telephone, cellular phone calls where you could just figure out what everybody's doing just with technology. Back then, you actually had to break into a physical place and steal papers. Well, they got caught doing it, and that's why President Nixon almost got impeached. He had to resign, okay? So if President Nixon had to resign for something like this, and Trump got impeached just by being accused of it, why does Obama get away with it? Why does Biden get away with it when they're clearly doing it 10 times, 48 times worse? And that's one thing we have to figure out, why they're doing this, what their motive was, and there has to be something to pay. Somebody has to pay for this. Somebody has to go to jail. Somebody has we cannot let them get away with it. And Biden is part of it. He was part of the unmasking group, and he did it for his political reasons, and he shouldn't be allowed to run against the president. And that's what should happen, and let's see how this goes. But the president should not let this go. He should take all these people to court, all of them.
Yeah, it's very sad. And I think the person, the true victim here that we all need to feel very sorry for is General Michael Flynn. His whole life was turned upside down. And it's very sad that this man's life was basically a pawn in political games. And it's very unfortunate. And I think it just goes to show that everything nowadays is political. Democrats are willing to burn this whole country to the ground just to make sure that Trump does not succeed as president.
And I agree. And that's what they're doing.
It's very sad. And on that point, the politics of COVID-19, like now it's becoming political, whether you wear a mask, whether you don't wear a mask, whether you open up your state economy, whether you are still on lockdown. What are your thoughts about that? When this whole thing started, everybody was on the same page. We're fighting against the virus. We're all in this together. And now it's all political. We need to keep the economy shut down. We need to keep it shut down. We need to open up. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are this. We have to remember the reason why we shut it down. The reason why we shut it down is because we did not want the hospitals to be overrun. Because in Italy and in other countries, they had so many cases in Spain that they could not keep up with the amount of sick people. So what they did was they kept everybody indoors. And hopefully by doing this, the initial impact of the COVID-19 wouldn't be that bad, and we wouldn't have an overflow of people in the hospital. Well, guess what? Not only did we not have an overflow, we are at 48% capacity, 40% in some states. So, I mean, these hospitals are laying off hospital workers because they don't have enough sick people in the hospital. They don't have enough people visiting the hospital. So we don't have the overflow of patients that we were expecting. And we're long past that. We're already on the way down as far as infections are concerned. So why not open? The reason why we closed is because the hospitals, so that the hospitals wouldn't be overflowed. They're not overflowing. So open it up. We sent a hospital ship to New York, wasn't used. We sent another hospital ship to California, wasn't even used. We opened up in Miami alone, a humongous tent hospital here for overflowing victims. Not even one patient was seen. In Miami Beach, same thing, a 3,000 bed hospital, nobody, portable hospital, not one patient. And all over the country has been the same thing. So we've never had the overflow of patients. So what's the purpose of keeping it closed? There is no purpose. It's just political. People don't get it. We're past the initial impact that we were supposed to have all these millions of cases. We don't have millions of cases. Let's open up. We got to take our country back. And those that are truly more, you know, to this disease need to take better, you know, we have to really look out for them, which is the elderly and those with immune deficiency problems. But other than that, everybody needs to go back to work, because if not, we can't afford to help those people. If everybody's broke and there's no money out there and nobody's working, then how can we take care of the sick? We can't. So we have to get back to work, and we should have opened a long time ago. And I really don't see why. The 18th of May is the magic number. And why can't, I mean, what difference does it make whether you open it today or whether you open it on the 18th? It makes zero difference. It should be open. I would like to also thank, you know, the governors of Georgia and Governor DeSantis for opening up the states and proving that you could open up the state and get a decrease in COVID-19 cases. And that has been the case. We've decreased while everybody who shut down has increased. So I think the key is to open and open up completely. We got to open up Miami-Dade, we got to open up Broward, and we got to open up Palm Beach and the Keys. The Keys are completely shut down. We got to open up the Keys. So other than that, I'm very happy with DeSantis.
And I agree with you. I think Governor DeSantis has done a very good job of having a very good handle of the situation and doing what's best for Florida, because what's good for Florida may not be the best for another state. So allowing the states wiggle room to do their own thing, I think it was a good approach from President Trump. I wanted to ask you too how COVID has been affecting your campaign. Obviously, you can't be knocking on doors. You can't have rallies. You know, the people component to running for office is gone. How have you adapted, and what new opportunities does this situation present as far as interacting with voters?
Well, I mean, thankfully, I have a big base on Facebook that follows me and shares my stuff and gets my word out there. So so I'm not totally shut down. But as far as knocking on doors, that's not happening. And one thing that I decided not to do until this whole crisis was over was fundraise. I have not asked anybody to lend me to give any money to the campaign. I don't think it's ethical. I think the people are suffering, and this is not the time to be asking people for money. So there's no fundraising. I'm also a big fan of doing events where I invite a bunch of people. We can't do that either. What we have done is done a few rallies to go to open up the county. Of course, while following some of the rules, you know, put on your mask and keep 6 feet apart. But nonetheless, to open, there should be no reason to keep us closed. So I have done that. I've done a couple of those rallies. I've also donated some stuff. My brother and I have a wholesale company that wholesales citrus and different produce and different vegetables and fruits and vegetables that I started many, many years ago. I started that company many years ago, and my brother took it over, and I went over there, I grabbed some oranges, and we gave it away to the senior citizens that I wanted at four different buildings of senior citizens in Miami, and they were very grateful. And this was right at the time when there really wasn't anything at the stores, and they really couldn't go either. So they were very grateful for it. So those are just some of the things we've done, the regular things, and it's more about what the, you know, what's good for the county, what's good for the city, what's good for the district, rather than what's good for my campaign. I'm more concerned with America. I'm more concerned with my city and my district than I am with my own campaign. I want everybody to come out of this okay. I don't want anybody else to die. But I also know that people need to get back to work. If not, there's going to be some serious mental problems, some serious health problems. A lot of people, if we want a healthy city and county, and country, we have to get back.
I just wanted to thank you for, you know, leading by example and going out to the community and care about people, and not because you want to score political points. So I admire that, and I want to thank you for doing that, because that's what we need more, selfless acts and more people helping people. And I think we can get through it if we are just, you know, we're patient with each other and we care about each other. So I give you kudos for that. And I want to thank you for coming on the show. If my audience wants to know more about you and wants to get in touch with your campaign, what do they need to do?
Just go to Facebook, and in Facebook, there's a Juan Fiol for Congress. Just type it. You'll have my campaign page. You could click on it. You could just monitor it. You could follow it. It's open to everyone. You could also get my Facebook page, which is Juan Fiol. That's J-U-A-N-F-I-O-L. And you could also go to Fiol, F-I-O-L, for Congress.com. You could go to that. But to keep up with the day-to-day type of thing, if you go to just my personal Facebook page, I have two of them, J-U-A-N-F-I-O-L. And you'll see me in front of Air Force One when I was picking up the president from the airport in one of the motorcades. I have one with the president. I have the other one with the vice president, a motorcade. And so you can't miss those pictures. You'll see Air Force One and Air Force Two behind me. And then again, Juan Fiol for Congress. You get a lot of stuff there that gives you events, gives you stuff that we're doing, that lets you interact with not only myself, but everybody in the campaign.
Awesome. So if you want to know more about him, guys, check him out at his social medias. Thanks, Juan, again. Best of luck. And I hope to call you congressman one day soon.
Thank you, Ariana. And I'd like to say that I've known you since the beginning of the campaign. A lot of people don't know this, but Ariana was one of the original members of the 2016 campaign for Donald Trump. And I don't know if you want people to know this, but I already rolled you under the bus. But you were there at the beginning, and I thought, you know, you were very smart, very articulate from the very beginning. And I'm really glad you finished you became a lawyer during that time, and now you're back in politics. And I'm really happy that you are taking up the political side of this again, even if it's in a podcast. So congratulations with your podcast, and I'm really glad that you put me on your show.
Thank you, Juan. And yeah, I remember those days very fondly, and you were always very enthusiastic, you're always very nice. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I'm back in the game. I took a little break, you know, got a new skill set, became an attorney, and now I'm back in. So hopefully hopefully I can help the cause, right?
I think you will, and I think you have great things coming to you. Thank you, Ariana.
Thank you. Take care, Juan. One thing that jumps out of my conversation with Juan is, as much COVID-19 has changed the dynamics of running for office in 2020, there's also still the issues that were there before COVID-19. Differences of policy, deep-rooted divisions as far as how to tackle the big issues impacting a state, impacting a district, impacting a region. And in that conversation about Cuba, you see, yes, we are tackling COVID-19. We're confronting this crisis together as a community, but there are still other issues that matter equally as well. And I think that is a very strong message about how we as a country need to learn how to multitask. We need to learn how to be able to keep safe, respect guidelines, make sure that we are practicing our best hygiene. At the same time, we need to go back to work. And there's so many other policy concerns out there that need our attention as well. We need to be able to do all at the same time. And that is an important note, because as we continue to open up the country, as states move out of phase one and into phase two and eventually phase three, we need to start having other types of conversations. We need to go back and discuss issues that are going to be here beyond COVID-19, economy, holding politicians accountable, accusations of corruption. All of these issues matter. And COVID-19 is now a new challenge that we need to confront as a nation, but we're all in this together. This should not be a partisan issue. Trying to find a vaccine, trying to keep people alive, trying to keep people healthy is not a red or blue issue. So as we approach the November elections, let's keep that in mind. COVID-19 should not divide us. It should unite us, because at the end of the day, there's plenty of issues that divide us. And finding solutions to those issues are challenging enough, but if you add the COVID component, it makes it almost impossible for us to talk to each other. And right now, we need to talk to each other. We need to discuss issues that we care about that are not COVID-19, at the same time making sure that people are following the guidelines and are being safe and taking care of their own. And unfortunately, we need to start having difficult conversations about how do we continue to open the economy? How do we give business owners the ability to run their business so that they can start hiring again? And I say it's unfortunate because I know that the idea of reopening our economy scares a lot of people. But that's a reality. We can't continue the status quo forever. So I want to thank Juan Fiol again for coming on the show. We wish him the best of luck on his congressional race. So next week, we have a very special guest, and I have invited to the show my friend from high school, Carlos Fernandez, and he's really a very talented individual. He's an interior designer, historian. He wears many hats, and he wears them so well. And I've invited him on the show because I think he's a great person to discuss double standards, specifically double standards that gay conservatives in this country have been at the receiving end for many years. And groups like Log Cabin Republicans have really been at the forefront trying to educate the public that there is a sector of the population that is proudly gay, but is also proudly conservative. And that is not a position that a lot of people in the mainstream gay rights movement accept happily. And oftentimes these gay conservatives are targeted because of their conservative points of view by the same people that like to lecture the rest of society that we should be accepting of others. So this conversation is worth having, and Carlos is going to share with us his story, his experiences, and it's a very interesting talk. I hope you enjoy it. And as always, if you like the program, please like and share with your friends and family. We are continuously looking for new listeners, so please share this content with those that you love. We are very proud to be starting new conversations in the community. We're very proud to be inspiring you to engage in new conversations and new debates amongst yourselves. So thank you so much for all the love that we have been receiving on social media about these very interesting topics. So join us next week. And remember, this is not your dad's political news show. So when you come and tune in to us, expect news in a new way. Thank you. See you next week.